We're going to take your phone calls now with Richard Vinatieri as we talk about his work, Mastermind, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, as you look into all this, that you've investigated, that what you have written about, what do you think the next few years are going to be for us here in the United States with regards to the possibility of terror?
I think that homegrown terror is a major risk. I think not just the Muslim converts, but also people who are immigrants to the United States or people who are born here are more likely to carry out attacks. I think, as we've seen in the attacks in England and in Scotland, that medical professionals, people, engineers, people you'd be the last people you'd expect could be radicalized through divisions of Al-Qaeda. We also, if you look at the Major Hassan case, remember the guy who shot up Fort Hood?
Yeah.
Killing more than a dozen people. He was in contact with a guy named Anwar al-Awlaki by email, getting permission to carry out attacks against his fellow soldiers. So I think we'll see the internet has become a powerful vector for causing terrorist attacks in the United States. The interesting thing is, why isn't Major Hassan being tried for treason? He's a serving, uniformed military officer of the United States, taking orders from an enemy foreign power. And I suspect the reason why he's not been charged with treason is, if found guilty, there'll be enormous political pressure to have him executed. I mean, we've never had a senior military officer convicted of treason in the past 150 years. And that President Obama would be politically difficult because Major Hassan is a Muslim. And the politics of that with the Democratic base become very, very tricky.
Well, you know what? A year to go for an election. So after that, anything goes.
That's right.
Let's go to the phones. We'll go to our wild card, Keith in Philadelphia. Get us started. Hi, Keith.
Good morning, George.
Good morning, Keith.
Yeah, I just think it's something strange about the World Towers going down the way they did. And then that third building that went down seemed like for no reason at all. But I'm kind of sort of like tired of hearing about that. I want to talk about what happened to the plane that hit the Pentagon. What happened to the plane that landed in the field? There was no planes found. And also the holes that the plane supposedly made was too small for the plane, you know?
Okay, well, let's talk about that for a second, Richard. The plane that went down in Pennsylvania, I think, might have been shot down by us. I don't think we had a choice. I don't know why we don't say that, though.
I don't think there was a plane in the area. Remember that there are only 14 planes available, supersonic intercepts were not permitted until after 9/11. All the intercepts, the supersonic intercepts that were permitted, over the Atlantic before 9/11 and on 9/11. So there was not clearance to go after commercial aircraft until basically those aircraft had crashed. As for the size of the hole in the Pentagon not being big enough for a plane, you know, people are kind of thinking about it in terms of, you know, like a cartoon where, you know, Elmer Fudd runs through a wall and you see the outline of Elmer Fudd in the wall. What happens when the plane crashes is the fuselage went, you know, the long, narrow, tubular part of the plane goes into the building. And, you know, the Pentagon's a series of layers, 8 layers, in fact. So the fuselage penetrated into a few layers, but the wings were sheared off. So the reason why the hole is smaller is the wings are gone. As for the parts of that plane, you can go into different Pentagon offices and people have them, believe it or not, on their desks and bookshelves. When he was Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld had a large piece of the landing gear on the waiting table in his reception area, and you could pick it up, touch it, whatever.
There's supposed to be some video that the FBI has that clearly shows the jet hitting the Pentagon, if they have it. Why don't they release that to us?
You know, there's a lot of things the FBI hasn't released. One of the things that I got my hands on was the timeline of what the hijackers were doing. This is a timeline put together involving hundreds of, or dozens rather, of FBI special agents looking at ATM records, rental car records, hotel records. And they were able to recreate, not quite minute by minute, but certainly throughout every day that they were in the United States, what they were up to. That has not been released publicly. I asked Phil Zekala, who's then the staff director of the 9/11 Commission, why don't you release more of these documents? And he said, well, I don't think anybody would care. And I said, well, I think there are lots of Americans who would care. And he said, well, we'd have to get permission from the FBI to do it. And they just basically didn't. They were too lazy to go through the paperwork required to release these documents. And I think that's exactly what makes people ask so many questions. It naturally leads people to think of a cover-up, when really laziness explains a lot more of human behavior than we care to admit.
Next up, we go to Thomas in Leipzig, Germany. Welcome to the program. Hi, Thomas.
Oh, hello again, George. I've got a theory about Bin Laden's location immediately after he blew up the World Trade Center, because I saw a video clip of him receiving some dignitaries in a tent somewhere on television. And during the course of that conversation, he was boasting about having his radio held firmly to his ear to listen for the news of it. It occurred to me that he wouldn't be listening to it on the radio. He'd be watching television like everybody else at the time. And then I thought, well, the reason he said that would be to disguise the fact that he was living in a country probably where satellite television had been banned. And the country that banned it at that time was Iran. So I thought, that's where he is, Iran.
Well, there are certainly a number of connections between Iran and the Bin Laden family. We have, before Saad Bin Laden was killed, he was married to the daughter of an Iranian Revolutionary Guards general. Some 500 al-Qaeda figures had taken shelter, mostly mid-level operatives, in Iran, according to Iran's own state-run radio reports. But apparently Bin Laden, and there's lots of evidence for this, his Abu Jandal, his former bodyguard, his driver, and so on, he was a big fan of listening to the BBC. He would put his fingers in his ears when the BBC would play the tones of music at the beginning of each hour. But he was fascinated by the BBC World Service News. And so I find it pretty plausible that he was listening to the radio because he preferred radio. And also, it's important to remember his own ideology. He believes that images of living things are forbidden by his version of Islam. And in fact, he had a big debate with a guy named Hassan al-Turabi, who was the radical Islamic leader of Sudan for a time while he was living there. And Turabi said, well, no, television's okay because it's very useful to get radical speeches out and to radicalize more people. And Bin Laden said, no, it's haram, it's forbidden in the not so much in the Quran, but in the Hadith, or interpretations of the Hadith, or the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad. And the argument back from Hassan al-Turabi was, well, TV is more like a reflection, and the Prophet's mother and his wife, his first wife, Khadijah, had a mirror, and so reflections are okay. And these are the kind of debates they got in for, you know, a very long time. Saudi Arabia had banned movies until the mid-1960s on the same argument that you can't show images of living things. So it's not surprising that a pious Muslim like him didn't want to watch television. We do know where Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other high-ranking al-Qaeda members were at the time of 9/11. They were watching television and were very excited when the first plane hit the towers. They thought that was it. They thought it was the entire attack.
They didn't expect the buildings to go down, did they?
They didn't expect the buildings to go down. They didn't expect the second plane. And so there's a great account of one of KSN's deputies saying, no, wait, brothers, wait, there's more coming.
I want to talk with you a second, Richard, about a Meet the Press interview with the Vice President Dick Cheney that happened on September 16th by the late Tim Russert. And he had asked the vice president basically about the plane that was going to be headed toward the White House that crashed in Pennsylvania. And the vice president basically said it was a presidential decision to take that plane down.
I'd have to look at the transcript again, but the last time I looked at the transcript, he said that there was going to be presidential authority to take down a plane if necessary, but not that the plane had definitely been taken down. And also, the target was not the White House, but the Capitol building. It's very easy to identify the Capitol dome from the air, but if you're not familiar with Washington or aerial photos, the White House is just a lot harder to hit with a plane. Especially,
of course, they were all hard to hit. The Pentagon was hard to hit, wasn't it?
Well, ironically, they hit the one side of the Pentagon that had the Pentagon had a five-stage plan for strengthening each of the five sides of the building, and they hit the side of the building. They crossed over 385 and they crossed the parking lots and then hit the side of the building that had been reinforced. If they hit the side facing the river, the Potomac River, where Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld's office was, and Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz's office also had a view of the river, they would have taken out the senior leadership of the Pentagon, and that was the wall that was going to be reinforced last. So, ironically, they picked the strongest part of the Pentagon to hit.
Is it possible that some group could have worked with bin Laden and al-Qaeda to convince them, to help fund them, as well as whatever bin Laden came up with?
To have a foreign intelligence organization?
Something. Somebody like that.
You know, I think that question needs to be more carefully examined. I mean, I would look, the first culprit to look at would be Iran, frankly.
Yes.
We know that a number of al-Qaeda operatives who carried out attacks in Iraq got there by going through Iran and having safe passage with the head of the al-Qaeda in Iraq for a very long time. Was known to make phone, there were German intelligence and British intelligence phone intercepts of the guy making phone calls from Iran. There are a lot of Iranian connections here that are kind of curious. Also, Iran has carried out attacks against American targets in the Middle East. The Air Force barracks that were bombed at Dalaran in 1996 are now widely believed to be an Iranian attack. A member of Sudanese intelligence thought that the Pan Am flight that the Libyans were blamed for blowing up over Lockerbie, Scotland, was actually done at the request of the Iranians. And the Iranians are very much involved in a very deep and sophisticated level at Middle East political events. The uprisings we've seen in the past year in Bahrain, which is an island that used to be run, or a peninsula that used to be run by Iran until the middle of the 18th century, the Iranians want it back, and that they are mobilizing a lot of the Shia there to demonstrate against the rulers of that country and against the U.S. presence there. The U.S. Fifth Navy Fleet is based in Bahrain. And then, of course, Iran is very much involved in Yemen. And in fact, Yemeni government officials have said that publicly, and they've told that to me privately as well. And there's some concern, if you look at the WikiLeaks, that the Egyptians had, that the Iranians were very much involved in efforts to overthrow Hosni Mubarak.
Mm-hmm. Who is going to stand trial now with his two sons.
Yes, that's right. And that could very well lead to a civil war in Egypt. That's a very dangerous thing.
Ironically, the extension of the Patriot Act expires on Friday. They're supposed to quickly get this thing passed through again. Were all these things necessary after 9/11, Richard?
Well, the Patriot Act is one of these things that really gets exaggerated. The powers that the federal government has under the Patriot Act are virtually identical to the powers the federal government had against the mafia in the 1970s. One of them is roving wiretaps, right? So if you know that your phone, or you suspect your phone or your cell phone might be listening to, what the mafia would do is just use payphones. And that's exactly what al-Qaeda did. Mohammed Atta, for example, made more than 700 phone calls to Germany and Spain from payphones inside the United States, hoping to avoid U.S. detection. And so
he did pretty good with that.
Yeah. So it's important to have these sort of, you know, roving wiretaps where the warrant to listen in on the phone call follows the person no matter what device they use, as opposed to saying, no, we can only listen to this phone and not that one. And that's one of the critical parts of the Patriot Act. And there are other parts. But all of these, the government has already had these powers, to pursue drug kingpins. So the question is, well, why is it that for 30 years the government's had this right to go after drug kingpins? Why is it a problem to use the same powers to go against terrorists? Frankly, I wish they'd, I'm more concerned about the terrorists than the drug kingpins myself.
I fly a lot. I see them patting down little old ladies, little kids in strollers. I mean, it just...
George, you know why they do that?
We've lost too much.
You know why they do that, George? They have a quota. So they need to demonstrate that they're not biased and they're not just searching Arab males.
Well, they should. I see nothing wrong with profiling?
Well, if it's smart profiling, I mean, if you just say we're going to search all Arab males, Al-Qaeda will recruit, you know, blonde females. You recruit around the profile. The profiling should be based on people who've got a tangible connection to Al-Qaeda. I mean, the Germans used a similar method in the 1970s and 1980s against the Biedermeinhof gang.
I know, but a little old lady, Richard?
Oh, yeah. I mean, searching little old lady with the walker. I mean, first of all, if the lady is with the walker is going to hijack the plane, I'd pay to see it. I don't know how that could be done, right? searching, you know, 80-year-old war heroes and 2-month-old babies. It's crazy. What the Germans did in the 70s and 80s against Biedermeinhof, they said, okay, we know who the leaders are. We know who the main members of this group are. If you ever shared a bank account with them, if you ever shared an apartment lease with them, a utility bill with them, if you called their home phone and, you know, an extraordinary number of times, we're gonna treat you as a member of this group.
Exactly.
And we're going to search you every time you get on a train or a plane.
We're going to take your shoes off, your clothes off, you whatever we have to do.
Right. But if and, you know, the FBI has a database of about 188,000 people globally who've made calls to high-level members of Al-Qaeda, right? If you've got Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's or Osama bin Laden's home phone number, you know, you're connected to the organization. And those are the people you should be searching. Not, you know, first of all, most, 2/3 of Arabs in America are Christians, not Muslims.
Well, even that. And you know, and I've said this repeatedly. People think that every Muslim is a terrorist. Not true. A small handful of them are
right.
fanatics.
Most victims of terrorism are Muslim.
Yes.
You know, but, you know, what you're looking for is people who share a view of the world that bombs can move governments to give that group what it wants. And so you're looking for membership in the group,
right.
And you can look in databases.
And I'm not sure the group knows what it wants.
Oh, it's very clear. If you read Al-Qaeda's documents, they want a worldwide single government under a dictator, a Khalif, who rules according to Sharia law. They're very open about it.
Not going to happen.
No. Well, let's hope.
Not going to happen.
You know, I don't think it'll happen either for a lot of reasons. I think there's really an intellectual civil war going on in the Arab Muslim world. They realize, you know, for much of the 20th century, it was a debate between Islamism and communism. And they've kind of figured out that both of these things don't work, and they're looking for a third option. And the third option, you know, is free market capitalism or something close to it. And I think that's what they're slowly moving toward, but it could be a generation or two before that happens.
Well, and once Israel and the Palestinians eventually work out some agreement. Eventually.
If you look at Israel's discoveries, massive discoveries of natural gas offshore, they could be energy independent in a few years once those gas streams come online,
mm-hmm.
development of those fields. That's going to have a tremendous effect because suddenly I think the Saudis and the Syrians and the Iranians who finance Palestinian terror attacks are going to realize that they can't beat these guys with energy. They know that they can't beat them militarily. Right. I mean, there's an old story of after the 1973 war, a Nixon administration official asked an Israeli general, is the Israeli army the best in the world? And his answer is, we don't know. We've only fought Arabs.
with us, Richard. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back with final phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, for less than 25 cents a day, you can become a Coast Insider, formerly Streamlink. And it's fun. Just go to coasttocoastam.com. Richard, where do you get your books? Out there in bookstores? Just off the website?
No, it's available in most major bookstores, amazon.com. And you can get it off my website, too, richardminiter.com.
What got you interested in covering terrorism?
You know, my brother Brendan almost died in the 9/11 attacks. I was working for the Wall Street Journal in Brussels, and he was working for the Journal in New York. And disappeared for the first 9 hours. I knew he would take the 8:30 train from Brooklyn, the subway into Manhattan, and get off at number 5 World Trade and walk up the steps and across the bridge to the Journal building. And so he would have been getting off the train as the first plane hit at 8:48 and disappeared. We were unable to find him for about nine and a half hours. And what had happened is, fortunately, he had cut himself shaving. He was standing on the platform in Brooklyn, waiting for the 8:30 train, noticed blood on his shirt, went home to change his shirt, ended up taking the last train into Manhattan, which didn't go all the way to the World Trade Center. It stopped at Christopher Street, saved his life. But then in the crowd and the dust and the long walk across the Brooklyn Bridge and through the shock streets of Brooklyn, you know, he was unable to get a phone call out to let us know he was alive. But it made me think, you know, what did we know about bin Laden before these attacks? And why did they want to kill us? And I realized I developed a lot of sources over the years covering Third World Wars and revolutions. I had a lot of intelligence and military sources in North Africa and in the Middle East and in Southeast Asia where al-Qaeda was active that would be useful in offering a unique reporting perspective. And so there's an old saying in investigative journalism, if you don't go, you don't know. I started traveling and reporting both for the Wall Street Journal and then later for the Sunday Times of London and then for my own books, talking to a lot of these people face-to-face. I spent hours with one of bin Laden's roommates in Khartoum, for example. Most, you know, as you meet the different people connected to bin Laden, you really get a deeper sense of the guy. One person who really surprised me was bin Laden's gardener.
His gardener?
Yeah.
He had a gardener?
Yeah, in Khartoum, he lived... And behind this, these 10-foot-high concrete walls that were topped with broken bottles. As I got a tour of his house, this is after bin Laden left, obviously, I saw this willow tree growing. Now, willows use a tremendous amount of water. And here you are on the edge of the Sahara Desert in Khartoum, Sudan. And I said, you know, why did he plant this tree, this willow tree that's using so much water? And... the Sudanese intelligence official who'd agreed to show me bin Laden's house said, oh, that's a good question. Well, here, we'll give you the name and number of the gardener. And I tracked him down in East Khartoum, and I talked to him. He spoke pretty good English. And he said that bin Laden asked him to plant the tree on purpose. He wanted it as a sign to his neighbors to show that he could afford the water bill.
Oh, jeez. Ego.
Yeah, it's these real-life details that bring these guys to life and really give you a different perspective on these people.
I had a relative by marriage who was on Flight 175. Leaving Boston, heading for L.A. that never made it. Doug Gowell, if anybody wants to Google search him, he was the brother of my mother's sister's husband.
Wow.
And... He was going to L.A. He was working for Avid Technology. He was the new marketing director and never made it.
Yeah, one of the guys on the first plane was an ex-Israeli Special Forces guy, and he's believed to have fought it out with two of the hijackers. I mean, the stories of some of these people on the planes, not just the Pennsylvania flight, but all the planes are fascinating.
What do you think happened on that plane, Richard?
Pennsylvania flight?
On any of them, in terms of just what they did and how they took them over.
Well, this is where, you know, I think we really need to investigate more, because there's absolutely no evidence of box cutters. If you look at the flight recorders, you look at the transcripts of all the phone calls made by both passengers and crew on each of the hijacked planes, they mention a variety of weapons, knives. One mentions a gun. There's a mysterious sort of chemical device, which may just be a fake, you know, them trying to fake out the passengers and scare them. But nobody mentions box cutters. And box cutters were initially suggested in a press conference the first few hours after the 9/11 attacks, because it was the only knife that was really sanctioned by FAA rules.
Well, you know, I was going to say, how did we know if they had box cutters? How did we even know they did?
It was speculation, and it's one of these speculations that got hardened into fact without any evidence. But no passenger or crew member describes a box cutter. There's no box covers recovered from the wreckage, right? There's no record of anyone checking a box cutter, nor would there be, I suppose. But the box cutters are a very handy suggestion to say that the FAA was doing its job. And the fact is, we know it wasn't. We know that that Al-Qaeda chose the airports that it did, Logan in Boston, Dulles in Washington, and so on, because they were ranked as the top five worst airports on the website of the Department of Transportation because they repeatedly failed security checks.
Weren't those cockpit doors always locked prior to that anyway? I can't remember anymore.
Oh, no, they were often open. And in fact...
So you could, like, look down the aisle and you could look right in, right?
You could look right in. And, you know, I mean, you probably remember the days when small children would be invited into the cockpit.
Yeah, I remember that.
And get a little toy metal plane or something from the crew. And also on some flights, union rules allow the pilots, if the captain says so, to smoke. And so what would happen is the flight attendants would go into the cockpit to get a quick cigarette break, not allowed for the passengers, obviously. And so those doors were open for a variety of reasons. And then, of course,
at what point do you think these hijackers were in control of the plane? And right after takeoff?
Fairly soon afterward, because the transponders go dark. They knew exactly what they were doing. That's another reason why, by the way, the jet fighters that were scrambled out of western Massachusetts were unable to find them. They were hiding in a very crowded commercial airspace, and their transponders were off. And so it was very hard to locate them. But the transponders go off within depending on the flights, 9 to 15 minutes in. I think the Dulles flight had the transponder on the longest, and that was 20-something minutes.
I think at this point, if I saw four or five guys get up and start rushing the cockpit, I think I'd just jump out in front of them as well as everybody else would.
You know? I think that would be the natural reaction.
Yeah. One, you think he's going to the bathroom. Four people, five people at one time like that? Nah, there's something wrong.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how quickly the passengers figured this out, right?
Yeah.
It didn't take a lot. We're not France. We don't require a government directive to figure things out. I don't think that form of attack would work again, but they're actively looking for other weak spots in our system. I mean, one of the reasons why Boston, Logan, had such a bad record is that the governor had appointed as the head of airport security his former chauffeur.
Oh, geez.
And so, you know, they study our websites. They study our newspapers and magazines and news broadcasts looking for weakness.
That's true. Let's go to the phones. Long Beach, California. John, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi, George. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, well, you know, I smell a rat big time, you know, because you can't tell me that Bin Laden with his $2 million, you can go up against the money that the CIA got. I'm not buying that, okay? This is crap, okay?
Well, what do you mean?
Osama bin Laden was groomed by the CIA because the CIA has way more money than he ever would have, okay? So they could do that. They funnel billions of dollars to the ISI in Pakistan. Where is that money going? What was that money for? That money was to build Al-Qaeda, was to build up on the Taliban, okay? So this was all created. And let me tell you something. If this is not a conspiracy, and Chicken and Poultry, and Mona Lisa definitely was a man.
Richard, there's been talk that Bin Laden came to Los Angeles. His name was Tim Osman, O-S-M-A-N, a long time ago at the request of the CIA. Woody, do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do. It is true that Bin Laden visited Indiana and Los Angeles, but he did it under his own name. And he did it in 1987. And this is the only evidence we have of this is from Najwa Ghanem, who was then known as Najwa bin Laden, his first wife. And she recalls a brief 4 or 5 day visit to the United States, which bin Laden went to see, I believe, Abdullah Azzam, who was then his mentor. As for the CIA funding Bin Laden...
Yeah, was he an asset? Was he a CIA asset?
I can tell you definitively no, and I'll tell you how I know. First of all, Bin Laden had always denied it from the 1980s onward.
Well, we would expect that.
Right. And I tracked down every CIA station chief who worked in Islamabad, Pakistan from 1980 onward, interviewed them each separately, and they have denied even knowing who the guy was at the time. But there's good reasons to believe that both the CIA and Bin Laden are telling the truth. Number one, there was a deal made between President Reagan and the Saudi government. This is public, and this has been reported in the Washington Post, New York Times, that the U.S. government would spend money financing the Afghan resistance, and they would empty their prisons and send Arab fighters to fight the Soviets. It would be a two-front war against the Soviets. And it was a dollar-for-dollar deal. So for every dollar that we spent, they would spend a dollar. In 1986, it peaked at about $500 million a year on each side, so almost $1 billion that year alone. But bin Laden was not an active fighter, despite what he later claimed. There's no evidence that he was involved in any battles, nor did he have a militant force at the time. Al-Qaeda is formed in 1989 after the Soviets retreat over the Oxus River and leave Afghanistan.
And they trained in Afghanistan, right?
They trained in Afghanistan, but their training camps open up in 1990 and 1991.
Why didn't we just take them out?
Well, at the time, they were the enemies of what later became known as the Northern Alliance. And they it was an intramural fight, and we didn't see any strategic purpose. He wasn't targeting us at the time. He was with his rhetoric. And he was a very minor figure, and he was seen as a guy who financed terrorism, not as a guy who... Remember, the training camps were not initially under Al-Qaeda's control. That happens a little bit later, 93, 94. And we were also very bad at detecting Al-Qaeda's role in events. I mean, Al-Qaeda was involved in what we later became known as Black Hawk Down in Somalia.
Right.
Al-Qaeda is involved in Bosnia, Herzegovina. And, we didn't see the role of Islamic terrorism in either one of these attacks until 10, 15 years later. I mean, the CIA really wasn't that well focused on Islamic terrorism.
He apparently got about $7 million a year of daddy's money. Did it stop after 9/11?
It stopped in 1994. What happened is they didn't mind him threatening to kill Americans and saying anti-American things. That never bothered the bin Laden family, despite what they said.
Once he threatened the Saudi family.
When he threatened to kill King Fahd in 1994, he lost his Saudi citizenship. And the bin Laden family was told they would lose all of their government contracts in Saudi Arabia unless they disowned and cut them off. And, they basically had to choose between keeping their own fortune or disowning Osama. And, he was one of 52 sons of Mohammed bin Laden.
But where did he keep his millions?
Well, he had an allowance of about $2 million a year, and he spent it. He spent a lot of it in the Sudan on road projects and other money-losing ventures. And the Sudanese were supposed to pay him, but what they did was they gave him money-losing businesses. They say, I'm very sorry, Brother Osama. We don't have the money, but we'll give you this bank. Well, the bank was losing money.
Right.
Well, we'll give you this cotton operation.
Oh, this flour company,
was losing
whatever.
Money.
Yeah.
And he was a terrible businessman. So he funded it through Gulf War oil sheikhs, wealthy Saudis, people giving it through bogus charities. And he conducted a lot of hunting, falcon hunting parties in Afghanistan and in northern Pakistan with...
fundraisers.
As fundraisers, yeah.
Let's go next to Vancouver and Washington. Chris, you're up with us. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi. I have a couple of questions for Richard. Now, I watched some of the Ancient Aliens. That's how I got to know about you. But there was a show on history. I know you covered this on the nuclear threat, but that's something that's been kind of worried. I mean, I know because I don't remember the particular name, but one of the things that the show was kind of saying was that we could see a nuclear attack? I mean, I know you said that probably not, but...
I think you and I were watching the same thing, Chris. It was on the History Channel, right?
Yeah, it was on the History Channel, and it got kind of weird. It almost opened up a conspiracy idea, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, no, they did, and we only got a couple minutes left. And Richard, you don't seem to be concerned about some kind of dirty bomb or nuke.
Oh, well, dirty bomb is a different thing. A dirty bomb is frighteningly easy to put together.
It is.
You could use radioactive hospital waste. You wouldn't even have to transport it into the country. You could probably get the radioactive waste here in the United States, and then you just wrap that around a conventional bomb, and there you go. An atomic device is different. Its triggering mechanism is sensitive. It needs to be changed often and calibrated. It's heavy. And you remember, we have radiation detectors in the New York City subway, for example. People who get radiation therapy, you know, in the hospital, have to carry notes on their doctors. Otherwise, they're questioned when they're questioned by the police.
There's probably more radiation, though, at that Japanese nuke plant.
Oh, to be sure. Yeah. But I mean, there's but air travelers, who people who spend a lot of time in the air, get the higher radiation, and they're sometimes questioned by the police. So there are a lot of hidden radiation detectors in public places now. We've become smarter about looking for any sign of radioactivity.
Ray is in Citrus Springs, Florida. Go ahead, Ray.
Thank you for taking my call. Long-time listener, you and Art. I had a thinking about the Pakistanis saying that they didn't know that he was there. Didn't he have kidney dialysis? Did they ever find a machine in his place, or was he walking down the street to the hospital to get it?
Good question. What is that story,
Richard? Well, kidney dialysis is a lie, a disinformation campaign created probably by Pakistani intelligence. The first, if you trace those stories back, they first appear in 1998. Following the bombings of the U.S. embassies in East Africa. The Clinton administration, after they failed to kill bin Laden, basically because the Pakistanis tipped them off that the cruise missiles were coming, the Clinton administration then put a lot of diplomatic pressure on Pakistan to help us get bin Laden into custody and put him on trial for the embassy bombings. The Pakistanis didn't want to turn him over, neither did the Taliban. So they floated the story in the Pakistani press, which then got picked up in Europe and the United States, saying, well, the guy's on dialysis, is probably going to die soon. We know that story's not true for three reasons. One, bin Laden's personal doctor was captured in Pakistan in 2002, and after he was interrogated, he was released, and he spoke openly to the Associated Press and to the New York Times, in which he said that bin Laden has absolutely no kidney problems. Doctors who've examined photographs of bin Laden and other evidence see no evidence of this skin coloration, other things you associate with kidney problems. And three, most importantly, they didn't find a dialysis machine in his house.
Nope, not at all.
Or anywhere nearby.
I wondered about that. Richard, I want to thank you for being on the program. 3 hours buzzed by pretty darn fast. Appreciate it. Richard Miniter, the book, Mastermind, The Many Faces of the 9/11 Architect, colleague Sheikh Mohammed. And here we are bringing you at least another side of the incredible, tragic story of 9/11. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.